Welcome, Apostolic Majesty. How are you doing?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, coming through loud and clear.
Oh, good. Thank goodness. I was worried my microphone was broken. So that's one result at least.
you can relax. And
thank goodness.
Let us discuss Jansenism. Shall I kick off with a question?
Yeah, sure.
What were the key theological principles of Jansenism? And how did they differ from the prevailing Catholic teachings of the time?
Well, I think I'd like to sort of underline this with a bit of context, really, as to why please. I approached this subject, why I suggested it to you. You came to me a couple of weeks ago to suggest some topics for me to come on. And you suggested a few religious movements during the medieval era. So you suggested the Hussites, the Cathars, the Lollards, etc. And after you suggested that series of possible stream ideas to me, I considered it would be perhaps more interesting and more unusual to focus on a religious controversy after the Lutheran Reformation within the Catholic Church, as opposed to another spin-off of Protestantism like Calvinism or even the nonconformist movements that you see in England or even in America. But there's another reason I wanted to look at this. When looking at the history of the French Revolution, it very much seems that on the eve of the French Revolution in 1789, a large section of the French elite had no adherence to conventional Catholic faith at all, to the point that they had basically absorbed the teachings of Rousseau as a new revolutionary catechism. And I had to wonder why that was the case, and there had to be some underpinning Christian crisis in order to explain that away, other than simply saying the triumph of the Enlightenment, etc. Because if you look back in the history of France in the 16th century is an incredibly tumultuous time. If you can say in many ways far more tumultuous than the Reformation in England. We have almost a dozen wars of religion, wars fought between a Catholic sect, the Catholic League, supported by the King of Spain, a Calvinist Protestant League, the so-called Huguenots, which are invariably supported by the Dutch, the Swiss, and by extension, Queen Elizabeth of England. And then you have the flagging monarchy of France trying to hold all these forces together. So Calvinism and the Reformation in France almost destroyed the French political system. And by the 17th century, what you see is the French trying to compensate for that and trying to override that anarchy of the previous century and create a new political and religious settlement to avoid those sorts of controversies. And it's within that context, within the context of this conflict between the Catholics and the Calvinists, that you have the Jansenists come in, which is why I'm interested in them, because they only appear at a time where it seems that Catholicism has now become politically ascendant. So, for example, the ideas of Jansenism are posthumously ascribed to one Cornelius Jansen, who was the Bishop of Ypres, who was then essentially appointed by the King of Spain, because Belgium, or the Spanish Netherlands at that point, was not part of modern-day Belgium, but was part of the Crown of Spain. And despite the fact he was no longer alive, he'd been dead for 2 years, in 1640, a body of work by him was published posthumously, the Augustinus. And effectively, what this was playing out an old argument, or you can say trying to revive an old argument, between St. Augustine of Hippo and Pelagius, as had been the case in the 4th and the 5th centuries AD, concerning the nature of divine grace, essentially. And so the book essentially rehashes these old arguments and tries to ascribe what Augustine of Hippo would have declared as Pelagianism and what was essentially the nature of original sin and divine grace. And what is interesting about Jansenism is that it uses the example of Saint Augustine of Hippo and tries to elevate him as a church father to the status of basically his theories and their interpretation of his theories as representing revealed truth, a revelation from God. And thereby everything that subsequently came after Saint Augustine that contradicted Saint Augustine's teachings is therefore heretical, even the established canon and the evolving understanding of theology as embraced by the Catholic popes and the Catholic Church. Mm. That is why Jansenism, coming from within the Catholic Church, emerged as quite a radical movement. But more than that, it adopted an interpretation of predestination, you can say, that of the idea of irresistible grace, which effectively ascribes the idea that you don't have free will. If God assigns grace to you, it's not a matter for you to reject it or accept it. Rather, you're almost compelled into a state of grace. And in that sense, it very much followed on from a Calvinist idea of the predetermined and the predamned, so to speak. And you can almost say, therefore, it had aspects of crypto-Calvinism within Catholicism that was coming about and trying to challenge the prevailing sort of dogma of the Catholic Church after Calvinism. But unlike Calvinism, it doesn't split off. It doesn't become its own new Protestant sect. It remains within the Catholic Church, and it adopts many aspects of the Catholic Church, which Calvinism had completely rejected, such as the emphasis on miracles and the emphasis on religious icons and religious relics and religious imagery in general. So in that sense, Jansenism is quite a unique phenomena, but also Jansenism taking place in France is pivotal in terms of understanding it, because France occupies a special position within the whole structure of the Catholic Church as the oldest daughter of the Church. The Catholic Church within France has many privileges which aren't bestowed onto other Catholic churches as well. Hmm. And so on top of all of this, this isn't just, you can say, creeping Calvinism entering into Catholic seminaries, which was the case at Magloire and Port-Royal de Champs. But it was also the case that this movement was attacking other organizations within the Catholic Church, namely the Jesuits. And it was also attacking the idea of papal infallibility as well. And in that sense, many Frenchmen were drawn to the idea of Jansenism because it espoused the idea of basically the French church for the French church and with no interference from the Pope.
Can we dive into that, the convent of Port-Royal de Champs, and talk about its development in the process of spreading Jansenist ideas? Am I right that Blaise Pascal and Jean Racine were both involved as sort of associated intellectuals with this convent?
Well, yes. The convent was established, I think, around the year 1608. So it had been a rather recent establishment. And it was headed by a particular abbess who was essentially responsible for inculcating these various ideas. But you bring up Blaise Pascal. Blaise Pascal had undergone a sincere religious conversion around about the 1640s. And by the 1650s, we have the first official attempt by the papacy to come down hard on the errors of Jansenism within the scheme of Catholic teaching. And it's within this context that Blaise Pascal is drawn to the ideas of Jansenism. He attacks the Orthodox Catholic position on free will, and he takes his argument in the form of a dialogue, the Lettres Provençales, and effectively thereby it's effectively an apology and apologia for the Jansenist position. And you mentioned other figures such as Racine. So Port-Royal de Champs was a major intellectual center within France, and of course people are aware of Blaise Pascal as a mathematician, as a philosopher, and of course for formulating the famous Pascal's wager as a possible, again, proof of God's existence. So you can say that this is a hotbed for heterodoxy within the Catholic movement. But it's important to say, however, that Cornelius Jansen, of course, wasn't he didn't operate within France. He operated within the Spanish Netherlands, and the ideas were more or less imported into France by one Anton Arnauld. Shortly after Janssen's death. So the idea that, you know, Janssen represented some sort of religious leader like Luther is simply not the case. Rather, this is all an interpretation of his ideas based on the Augustinus. And the movement basically follows on in his wake based on people interpreting his theories, most notably in France.
Do you think there's an extent to which Jansenism was a response to sort of the perceived moral laxity within the Catholic Church? There's this intellectual sphere about predestination and grace and so on. But to what degree was it part of the broader Catholic Reformation?
By the broader Catholic Reformation, you're referring, of course, to the Tridentine Reformation. So obviously in the 1540s, 100 years before the Jansenist controversy, we have the Tridentine Reform promulgated by Pope Paul III, under which there was a huge attempt to reform and purify the Catholic Church in response to the threat posed by Lutheranism. So I think you can say that there is an aspect to which there is a reforming zeal within the Jansenist movement. However, I can't help but feel that it's a response to Calvinist ideas and Calvinist critiques rather than following in the spirit of the Tridentine Reform, because a key aspect of the Tridentine Reform is the renewed powers of the papacy. You can say for the papacy, that's one of the great successes of the Tridentine Reform. One of the reasons that a pope had been unable or unwilling to hold a council for over 100 years up until that point, from the Council of Basel in the early 15th century up to the Council of Trent, was the fear that a council would basically offer an ultimatum to the pope, saying that it is the bishops assembled, the idea of conciliarism, the idea that it is the collective hierarchy of the Catholic Church that is supreme and not the Pope, was the great fear of the Pope at that time. But instead, the Tridentine Reform emphasized the powers of the Pope and reconfirmed them. And monarchs simply became responsible for implementing the reform edicts which were coming out of Rome. And in this case, Jansenism was the complete opposite of that. Jansenism was in all forms, regardless of whether you were just a explicit Jansenist, i.e. someone who had followed along with the five errors which had been condemned in the papal bum cum auctione, or you were just sympathetic to the idea, to their ideas. People who were sympathetic to their ideas were less sympathizing with them on a theological level. They were sympathizing with them because they were anti-papal. Anti-papal in the sense that we don't simply want to take all of our orders from Rome. Not only do we not want to take orders from Rome, but we are also resistant to the overarching authority of the Catholic clergy within France. So we want to emphasize the power of the local parish priests and the autonomy, the intellectual autonomy of the various seminaries and abbeys as well. So you can say that there is a movement to devolve the Catholic Church and allow some liberty within its theological context within this movement, which is in complete contrast to the spirit of the Council of Trent.
Could you give a quick summary of the five ideas or five propositions?
Yes, I've got them sort of written in front of me. Just I think I might have deleted it by accident. Give me a second, and I'll find it. Okay, here.
Okay.
Cum Occasione was promulgated in response to the Jansenists by Pope Innocent X, and again, this just outlines more or less what I've already been saying in terms of bringing back these old arguments between Saint Augustine of Hippo against the Pelagians. Yet at the same time, it's bringing these Calvinist ideas about irresistible grace. But regarding the first point, this is something I want to sort of dive deeper into, because it's something I think that is still controversial within the Catholic Church today, more than just the issue around Jansenism, because of course Jansenists are still around today. And the first proposition is this: that there are some commands of God that just persons cannot keep, no matter how hard they wish and strive. And they are not given the grace to enable them to keep these commands. So again, in response, you can say to this reforming zeal, this is actually a very pessimistic idea that human beings who aren't, again, given this providential grace, this predestined grace, are thereby unable to keep the commands. And this follows through in Jansenist practice by their, I wouldn't say hostility, but their skepticism towards the Catholic teachings on communion. So the Catholic teaching on communion is essentially that so long as you are free of mortal sin, you should take communion, and you should take communion as often as possible. Pope Pius X, in the earlier 20th century, was so keen on access to communion that he even lowered the age of first communion for children as well. So the idea within the Catholic Church is constant renewal. You go to confession, you absolve yourself of mortal sins, you are forgiven by God, and you take communion as often as possible. Whereas the Jansenist position is the complete opposite of that, that communion should be denied on the basis that even though humans, human beings are not necessarily tainted with mortal sin, they are still tainted with venial sin. And until one essentially absolves oneself of venial sin, one shouldn't take communion. So that, you can say, is probably the most enduring legacy of the Jansenists within the Catholic movement, is their stance on communion, whether we take it often or whether we don't take it, bearing in mind our own proclivities, our own descent into sin, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm interested in how you reconcile that with 1 Corinthians 10:30. I mean, not you. How the, I guess, the Jansenists, because that was the verse that came to mind for me, was that God is faithful. He won't let you be tempted beyond your ability, but mm-hmm. with the temptation, he also gives you a way of escape that you will be able to endure it.
Yes, exactly. And of course, I come from the Orthodox Catholic point of view, that God doesn't put more responsibility or more sort of onus on you than you can manage, in the same way that I also believe in free will. I don't believe in predestination. So the idea of
you're not here to defend the Jansenists.
Oh no, I'm interested in the Jansenists, which is why I brought them up. Nevertheless, I think it's interesting to examine their beliefs, and of course even the position essentially that one should be aware of venial sin when taking communion isn't a direct contradiction of scripture, I believe, but it's nevertheless a less sympathetic reading compared to the Catholics, who believe in the gift of communion, and that is a gift that you should routinely receive as often as possible. And again, these ideas about grace within the Jansenist position is followed up with that it is impossible for fallen persons to resist interior grace. And of course, that explicitly contradicts the Catholic position, which is that Christians are free to accept grace or they are free to reject it. And of course, this reinforces the idea of predestination. And this is simply confirmed again by the final statement, that it is semi-Pelagian to say Christ died for all. And the assumption, therefore, is that Christ died only for the predetermined to be saved, effectively, that Christ didn't allow for everyone to be saved. Rather, there were already those determined before creation to be saved. And effectively, life is simply the playing out of that process. And what we mean by semi-Pelagian, of course, the Jansenists ascribe semi-Pelagianism as this compromise, this weaker form of Pelagianism, but it is still a version of Pelagianism which Saint Augustine of Hippo fought against. And so effectively, they're discrediting Catholic doctrine by trying to ascribe Catholic doctrine to the arguments of Pelagius back in the 5th century in order to justify these theological beliefs. So, like, you can say, aspects of the Reformation, it is attempting to go back to an earlier source and declare that subsequent teaching on the matter is irrelevant, effectively.
And I'm very familiar with Calvinism, and there tends to be 5 points of Calvinism, and I'm interested to try to find where they are similar and different. The second proposition that you've just explained is the same as one of the 5 points of Calvinism, which is called irresistible grace.
Yes.
So we've got the first one was different, the second one matches, and that you mentioned the semi-Pelagian position that Christ died for a specific set of people.
Oh, no, that's not the semi-Pelagian position. This is what the Jansenists believe the semi-Pelagian position is.
But that's got the name limited atonement under Calvinist theology. What's number three?
Three is very much following in from number two, that it is possible for human beings who lack free will to merit. So basically it's a confirmation of the three points, which is that free will isn't essentially necessary in terms of to do good or to receive grace effectively.
The opposite of this view would be everybody is damned, I guess, based on the first two.
Or, you know, the opposite is another opposite is liberation theology, that everyone is determined to go to heaven at some point as well. I think what I find interesting about this is that this is happening within the scheme of the Catholic faith, but across the channel, Anglicanism has been beset by Arminianism, which in many ways is everything that Jansenism is not. Is attempting to moderate the Reformed position on predestination. It is basically, if I can remember correctly, Arminianism declares that God has foreknowledge of who's going to be saved, but he doesn't predetermine who is going to be saved. Is that correct?
So the way I understand it is that Arminius was preaching the opposite of all the 5 points of Calvinism. And in fact, the 5 points of Arminianism were explicitly listed first. And then Calvinists, the later followers of Calvin, came up with their 5 points as a kind of clarification. So just quickly then, total depravity, saying that mankind is completely incapable of a free will decision to go to God. The opposite would be, you know, mankind has it in his ability to make that free will decision to follow God. Unconditional election means God doesn't choose based on anything. So therefore, Arminianists would say that God, presumably on the basis of whether that person, as you were saying, will choose or not. I think the position you just laid out is actually subtly different from Arminianism. The idea of God having middle knowledge, right? The kind of, he knows the counterfactuals. I think Arminius would not affirm that. I think he believes that God doesn't know who will choose him, and it is a genuine free will decision. I hope I'm not misrepresenting the Arminian position.
I'm basing this off a lecture I did a while ago now, probably 6 months ago now, on the theology of King Charles I of England and Scotland. So I may be misremembering what I was outlining.
Yeah, Nathan says Molinism. That's right. That Molinists believe that God's election is on the basis of his foreknowledge of which people will choose him on a free decision. Whereas Arminius, so again, to go through the rest, so limited atonement on the Calvinist side, unlimited atonement, or, you know, does Jesus die for everybody or just for those people who, for the elect? I was irresistible grace. So again, the Arminianists would believe that the grace can be resisted. People who have been called can kind of deny that call. And then perseverance of the saints. Calvinists believe that once you are saved, it's impossible to fall away. You're saved forever. Whereas Arminianists believe that it's possible for somebody to both make a free will decision to follow God, but then also they can then make a free will decision to cease following God. That's all under the Protestant umbrella. And so what we're seeing in this stream is those ideas in France affecting the theology of the Catholic Church.
Well, what I find interesting is that Nathan brought up the Molinist position, and it's very pertinent for this discussion that he does bring up the Molinist position, because, of course, the Molinists were not in the Reformed tradition. They were out of the Jesuits. I believe Louis de Molina was a Spanish Jesuit priest around the same time as Arminius. And effectively what the Jansenists believed was that the Jesuits, by Molinism, were reviving the Pelagian and semi-Pelagian positions. So the Jansenists were effectively the second coming of St. Augustine of Hippo, and the Molinists were the Neo-Pelagians, if that makes sense. And it's within this religious scheme that these two sides came to blows, also given the temporal battles, in that the Jesuits were the strongest advocates of the papal prerogative, of the powers of the Pope, whilst the Jansenists stood in opposition to that. I think it's also therefore interesting to bring this within the political context of France, because on the one hand, Louis XIV, who becomes King of France in 1643, he reaches his majority in the year 1660, is famed for reviving the Catholic cause in France. But it's not that simple. I mean, many people remember him for the Edict of Fontainebleau, where in 1685, Calvinism, the Huguenots, are basically declared an illegal sect within France. The previous tolerances, the Edict of Nantes, which had been conferred to them, their place de sûreté, their fortresses, had already been dismantled at this point. And therefore, we have a huge influx of Calvinist Hugos flooding throughout Europe, perhaps most notably into Brandenburg, where they then go up and build up the Kingdom of Prussia. But this is interesting because it ignores another aspect of Louis XIV, which is his sworn adherence to Gallicanism, the idea that it should be the sovereign of France who is responsible for the confirmation of bishops and not the Pope in Rome, effectively. And this is reinforced by the 1682 Declaration of the Clergy. He eventually has, Louis XIV eventually has to give up this position. But when he's at the height of his power in the 1680s, when it looks as if the Holy Roman Emperor, the Vienna, is about to be stormed by the Turks, he has an ally on the throne of England, King James II, who also happens to be a Catholic. So the Holy Roman Emperor, the Dutch, seem to be on the back foot. In terms of all the temporal significance of the King of France, you can say that he's almost like the new Charlemagne in the 1680s, and he's going to impose a new Catholic settlement on the Pope. In many ways, you can say that he's trying to declare the supremacy of royal power over that of papal power. And this is, again, where you have this weird synergy between Jansenist ideas against the Molinists, against the Jesuits who are coming out and advocates for the Pope. And this is why people look at the very famous Bossuet, the Bishop of Meaux, as a potential Jansenist, because there's no one who is a greater apologist for absolutism in France, basically admonishing the rights of the nobility who had risen up against the monarchy of France in the previous century as a result of this newfound fanaticism which had been inspired by their visit to Geneva and receiving the sermons of John Calvin, effectively. So it doesn't seem, therefore, too far-flung to me to look at this conflict between the Molinists and also, by extension, the Christian mystics, the quietist controversy and all that, against the Jansenists, and see that Jansenism was a large umbrella movement beyond these 5 points, and that many people were drawn to it due to, for political reasons, as much as theological reasons as well. But this begins to take a radical turn at the end of the 17th century and into the 18th century, where you can say things with Jansenism become really interesting. As for the Huguenots within France, many Huguenots leave, others do not leave, in particular in the south of France near the Rhone Valley, where they become the Camusards, which is basically an ongoing guerrilla movement of French Protestants acting against the King of France. And when Louis XIV suffers the defeat at the Battle of Blenheim, and it looks as if France is going to lose a war against Britain and the Holy Roman Empire, the Huguenots who are left within France use this as an opportunity to fight back and assert their rights and regain some notion of tolerance, albeit this fails, and they're not going to succeed until on the eve of the French Revolution. As for the Jansenists, they take the temporal weakness of Louis XIV and the Catholic cause in France as essentially a cue to reassert their rights and that of the lower clergy, that of the ordinary parish priests, against the Catholic hierarchy, who are now more subservient to the Pope, now that Louis XIV has been humbled in his ambitions to basically force the Pope into a second-rate position within the Catholic Church. And this is confirmed through the Unigenitus Deo Filius, or the only begotten Son of God, which is the apostolic constitution of Pope Clement XI in 1713. Which, among other heresies which have been decried by the Catholic Church, it lays particular charge against the Jansenists. The direct quote from it is the false, ill-sounding, offensive to pious ears, scandalous, pernicious, rash, injurious to the Church and its practices, seditious, impious, blasphemous. You get the point in terms of all the admonitions which the papacy is landing at the door of Jansenism. And what is interesting is the reaction to this within France, because a lot of people see this not as just an attack on Jansenism, but they see this as an attack on the liberty of the individual parish priest within France. They see this as an attempt to compel Louis XIV into a subordinate position underneath the Pope, and by extension, the entire Catholic Church within France. So many people who are Jansenists oppose Unigenitus. But a lot of fellow travelers also oppose this, and they become the appellants. And this forms a large controversy towards the end of the reign of Louis XIV and the beginning of the reign of Louis XV. But before I go on and explain how Jansenism really transforms during this time, is there anything you want to say regarding those points I've raised?
Well, only that I'm interested in this this curious overlap at this time between what's going on the religious landscape and then also what's going on the political landscape. So you've got this kind of growing dissatisfaction in France with the Ancien Régime, right? And you've got the brewing revolutionary ideas. You've also got this raging battle on you know, where you've got these various religious movements. So the Jansenists that we're looking at, you also mentioned like Quietism, and you've got the Calvinists and the Arminians, the other, you know, byproducts of the Protestant Reformation, and is it Gallicanism or Galatianism?
Gallicanism after Gaul. It just literally means asserting the rights of the Church in France, the idea that France is a peculiar case within the Catholic world. It is the eldest daughter of the Church. And this doesn't date back to any sort of theological argument. This is simply due to the fact that in the early 14th century, King Philip IV basically took the Pope prisoner and forced him to move his seat from Rome to Avignon. So basically, it's simply a reflection.
I visited Avignon last year, actually. That was quite interesting.
How wonderful. But No, this is a political legacy more than it is a theological legacy. But nevertheless, even though the Pope is now back in Rome, France still has these pretensions, which are interestingly enough, brought up every a century or so.
Because it's just something that I've always wondered about. To what degree is the story of the Church over the last 500 years in Europe a political story? Because it's usually focused on as a, you know, these people had these theological convictions and these people were denounced by those people. But I can't help thinking that there was a serious political angle for which, to some degree, the as happens so often, the religious tribalism is sort of a secondary concern, you know.
Well, I'm very cynical in this regard, and this is why, I look at Lutheranism, and I see the success of Lutheranism not just due to the charisma and, I have to admit, the genius in many aspects of Martin Luther and his personality. It has everything to do with the particular context within Germany and the Holy Roman Empire at that time, which is very conducive to being against the powers of the Pope, and by extension, the powers of the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. So I see this as much as a political rebellion, as much as a religious rebellion. But saying that, I can understand that all the arguments from the Protestant point of view are there, based on the endemic corruption within the Catholic Church at that point. But of course, as a Catholic, having admitted that, I will say it's still wrong to break the fundamental unity of Christianity over the corrupt status of the Church as it existed in the early 16th century. But that's obviously my view.
Yeah, it's a coalition, isn't it, of people with different motives, but with aligned goals for a period. The people who want to... who have genuine theological convictions, and then the people who for whom the current religious landscape is politically inconvenient.
Absolutely. I think that's a fair way of looking at it. But for the Jansenists, they were an inconvenience. You can say that the Calvinists were quite useful in terms of the political context, because they effectively allowed various nobles within France to receive foreign backing. I'm going to say it very cynically, more than just the idea of religious toleration being granted to them. So, for example, when you have the Siege of La Rochelle, they are supported by the King of England, King Charles I. When you see the first sort of wars against Catherine de' Medici and the late Valois kings of France, they are supported by various powers around France who are trying to interfere in its internal political situation. And I think the most extreme example of a religious issue being used as a springboard for political agitation is the Dutch Revolt, which is also happening around the same time. But for Jansenism, this doesn't really happen. Jansenism has an odd transfiguration at this time. So Unigenitus comes out, and ultimately the French Catholic hierarchy, the bishops, go along with this, and they begin to repress Jansenism. They do it through the police machinery in France, and they do it through the Parlement, which are the local legislatures existing throughout France. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean Jansenism is going to go away. And one of the appellants against Unigenitus was one, François de Paris, who was a young man who had been raised and a member of the Augustinians. And he suffers smallpox at an early age, which disfigures his face. And from the 1720s onwards, he becomes essentially a self-declared monk. He becomes a rogue Jansenist holy man, and he begins to adopt aspects of self-mutilation, such as self-flagellation, in order to essentially verify his own sense of piety. And this is quite unusual for the Jansenists. And by the time he dies, he's only sort of in his 30s when he dies, he has already created a crop of admirers who look at him as a reincarnation, not a reincarnation, but a second coming of St. Francis of Assisi, which is very much the model of poverty and the model of piety and monastic living, of which François de Paris had attempted to emulate. That combined with the aspect of the mortification of the flesh, and you can say the desire to live within the realm of pure spirit, pure prayer, as opposed to being confined to the world of flesh, which François de Paris was very much agitating against. And a couple of years after his death, we have a lot of pilgrims going to his tomb, and they begin to experience miracles. In particular, they begin to experience convulsions whenever they meet him. People would enter the tomb, and they would. There are stories where people were apparently lifted into the air. We see foaming at the mouth. We see weird facial contortions. We see hysteria. We see screaming. We see speaking in tongues. And this happens often enough where it begins to become a phenomena of its own. And eventually, these people become a group, and they are called in French, the convulsionnaires. And strangely enough, they then become their own apocalyptic, millenarian, religious, Jansenist cult, who are dedicated towards a more extreme version of self-flagellation, which had been utilized by their original, essentially, post-hoc founder, François de Paris. And it's not just the fact that they practice self-flagellation, it's the extent with which the convulsionnaires practice self-flagellation. They even practice mock crucifixion in terms of the extremity of their mortification of the flesh. And they believe this formed a process called secor, release, whereby they were effectively removing themselves from the mortal plane, and they were becoming one with God, completely deprived of disease, sinfulness, and corruption. And they were effectively in terms of justifying this, they basically looked themselves and said, well, the Jansenists are being persecuted everywhere. We are not accepted within polite society. The Catholic hierarchy have turned against us. So we are effectively emulating the model of the early Christians who have been suffering and suffered martyrdom under the Roman pagan state, especially under Diocletian, before we see the advent of the Emperor Constantine. And what begins, you can see, as a sincere religious movement, which comes as an outcrop of Jansenism, becomes effectively, this isn't me sort of deriding the Jansenists, in case there are any Jansenists in the audience who are going to just say that I'm a Jesuit propagandist, but invariably, these organizations just became involved in mutilation and torture, sex and sadomasochism once the strict religious aspect of it was removed. And the reason for this is that they emphasized spiritual unions which focused on unmarried women, virgins in particular, experienced convulsions, who would be welcomed into these societies and then would be immersed into this sadomasochistic, violent and sexual atmosphere. So this became a particular fascination, obviously, for quite a lot of thinkers within France during the 18th century. And it wasn't just Catholic thinkers who were commenting on them. It was also the philosophers, those who would end up writing the Encyclopedia, and the thinkers like Voltaire. On the one hand, people looked at them as a genuine source of opposition to the Ancien Régime, and in particular, the debauched reign of Louis XV. And others, like Voltaire, looked at them as the most extreme example of religious fanaticism. But you can say that this is as much a consequence of the political situation that they have found themselves cut off and suppressed. The first regent of Louis XV, Cardinal de Fauré, had roundly suppressed their leadership. The most prominent Jansenists either became crypto-Jansenists, many of them were in various parlements throughout Paris operating as lawyers, but others went into exile and published their own pamphlets. The most noteworthy of this is the Nouvelle Ecclésiastique, in which they routinely denounced the Jesuits. And what I find rather funny about this is, in some ways, the Jansenists won. In the short term, at least, because the Jansenists looked at Louis XV and they saw him as an antichrist. In terms of the vast sort of literature we have on him, of course, the convulsionaires were very insistent on them having revelation, them having visions. And in their songs and their visions, they talk about Louis XV being the second coming of Pharaoh and that they shall be delivered, like Exodus, from this slavery which has been imposed to them by the system of French absolutism. Indeed, there were various figures, high-ranking figures within the convulsionnaires, such as the Abbé Vélon, who referred to himself basically as Elijah and as a prophet within this movement. And increasingly, of course, this sect was completely without any official purview from the Catholic Church. Even though they were still nominally Catholics, they had in all sense apostatized from the Catholic faith. But what I find funny about this is that they began to win various political victories. So in the 1760s, what happens? The King of France suppresses the Jesuits. It wasn't just a situation that happened in France, of course. I believe the beginning of the suppression of the Jesuits was the result of the machinations of one Marquis de Pombal in Portugal. But it spread to France and spread to Bavaria, spread to the Spanish Empire. And by the end of the 18th century, the Pope basically had to accept what had already been presented as a fait accompli, that his most ardent supporters, the original Jesuit order before it was reconsecrated, had been suppressed. And ultimately, the Jansenists took this as a complete verification of their own beliefs, that they, as the the new spirit of Saint Augustine had triumphed against the Pelagians. And of course, in terms of understanding the setup, this to me makes a lot of sense in terms of understanding why so many of the clergymen in France, the lower clergy, would go on to become members of the third, members of the Third Estate and members of the new National Assembly within France. And by extension, why they would take the civil oath of the clergy, where they would accept a solemn oath to the state rather than to the Pope, because the preceding movement within the Catholic Church was there. Yes, on paper, the Huguenots had been defeated. Absolutism had won. The nobles who had gone along with the Protestant heresy within the 16th century had been humbled. They had to fight over the right to hand a particular garment to the King of France, such as their abject humiliation during the situation. And yet by the 18th century, you can say the earnestness of the Catholic cause within France had been associated with the corruption of a particular clique. Then you have things such as the diamond necklace controversy involving the Archbishop of Strasbourg, the Cardinal de Rohan. And I tried to look at sort of opposition to this within the Catholic movement, attempts to revive Orthodox Catholicism within France. And you look at movements like the devout movement within France. But they had both attempted, on several attempts, to groom various members, various dauphins, to assume the throne of France and initiate a religious conversion. One was the Duke of Burgundy, who was the grandson of Louis XIV, and another was the original Dauphin, the son of Louis XV. In both cases, the Duke of Burgundy and the Dauphin of Louis XV both predeceased their kings, and so the teachings of the devout faction who wanted to bring about a restoration of the unity of Christendom were undone, and instead you were presented with these figures with no real religious footing, you can say. If you look at Louis XVI, for example, he was very much, for all the criticism focused against him, he was very much enamored with at least a moderate form of the French Enlightenment, and he put into place many of their policies. So I find it interesting, looking at the eve of the French Revolution and looking at this ongoing religious schism, not between different religious denominations within France, but within one umbrella denomination, that is the Catholic Church within France.
Do you want to comment on to what degree does your sort of cynical attitude, whereby you're seeing these religious bodies as acting in their kind of political interests, that was the same criticism that was leveled by the thinkers of the Enlightenment. So do you have the same perspective on this time period as the Enlightenment thinkers?
I think you can probably expect that I don't have the same opinion as the Enlightenment thinkers. I look at this and I simply decry the fact that you can say the earnest reformers were out of power, is what I would effectively decry. And I can look at the religious fanaticism of the Jansenists, and I can, to some extent, apart from the abject debauchery, I can't...
You're not going to stand up for that.
I'm not going to stand up for these almost Mormon-esque practices involving spiritual unions with virgins. No, I'm not going to stand for that. But I can understand why, given the situation in France at that time, you have a morally corrupt king, a man who is, you know, receiving fresh virgins in Paris from, due to the machinations of his maître sans titre, the Madame de Pompadour, a man who had taken France to war several times and left France weaker and financially and basically morally bankrupt. I think you can understand, given the nature of and the corruption of the French hierarchy at that time, why such religious movements, sincere religious movements, will come about. Of course, the philosophers who ultimately took over and superseded the French monarchy were not the Voltaire types who looked at this all cynically and believed that we should abhor aspects of religious fanaticism. Rather, it was a religious fanaticism which we can say, in terms of Rousseau and ultimately the Jacobin faction and Maximilien Robespierre, that they were representing a mutilated, bastardized, extreme form of Christianity, which expressed itself as the most extreme anti-Catholic cult. But you can say that on a much smaller scale, that had already been exhibited in France with Jansenism.
You can see how this context would lead people like John Locke and Thomas Jefferson towards advocating for the separation of church and state, right? They're looking at the recent history of France and saying the best thing is to just remove religious influence over the state.
Well, it's not just John Locke and Thomas Jefferson that would agree with you. It would be the King of Prussia and the King of Spain and the King of Portugal, and to some lesser extent, the King of France. In limiting the power of the Jesuits and trying to establish these larger bureaucracies that were based on the principles of Cameralism, rather than using what effectively the old bureaucracies of the medieval era was determined on clerical appointments. No, that's no longer the case. We are talking about large secular bureaucracies which have been established by nominally Christian monarchies. So really you can say that the damage had already been done before the French Revolution, and the French Revolution was simply the seizure of power from a more radical faction, a class who had been disempowered. I know I sound awfully Marxist there, but there is an element of truth in it, who was seizing power from another class who had basically been politically compromised and intellectually and morally impoverished. And I think it's actually illusory to imagine there is ever going to be a separation of church or state, because simply what we're detailing here is the fall of one religion and the rise of another to take it over. And of course, that was the most extreme case within the terror within France. And of course, in opposition to that, what was Napoleon's response to that? Napoleon's response wasn't to abolish religion or to take a Voltaire aspect of religious cynicism. No, it was to bring back Catholicism as the lesser of two evils. I think just a final point on Jansenism before I leave today. It should be noted that Jansenism has many facets. Even though the Convulsionnaires are fascinating as a particular sect, I mean, Maistre regarded the Jansenists as part of a dark hierarchy called the sect, effectively. All of these modernist or sort of heretical forces which are assuaging not only the moral orthodoxy of the French state, but they were attacking the very notion of order itself. So de Maistre was looking at this not only from the view of religious heterodoxy, but he was seeing these religious fanatics as being completely unamenable to authority in any form, even if that authority at the time happened to be corrupt. And you can say that the more extreme of the Convulsionnaires had a point. So this current of skepticism towards authority that you see in the Jansenists, this skepticism towards ultramontanism, it doesn't just end with the suppression of the Jesuits, which you can say is a Jansenist victory in many ways, even though it's not utilizing Jansenism as a pretext by the powers that be to suppress the Jesuits. And this is confirmed when you have the formal declaration of papal infallibility in the First Vatican Council in 1870, because many Jansenists then go on and become old Catholics, those who reject the idea of papal infallibility, those who take the Lord Acton line that absolute power corrupts absolutely, which is supposedly based off the idea of papal infallibility, although I think it exposes that he had a very weak understanding of Catholic theology in order to make that assumption and make that assessment of what papal infallibility means. But as a result of that, many Jansenists blended into the old Catholic movement. And there is even a old Catholic church today, which is operating in the Netherlands, the Archbishopric of Utrecht, in opposition to the official Catholic Archbishopric of Utrecht. So they're still around. And I'm sure if there are any devout Jansenists in the audience, they would simply be saying that I'm espousing Jesuit lies. But I assure you, I have as little sympathy towards the modern Jesuits as I do towards the modern Jansenists.
You're just watching them like two siblings fighting off in the distance.
Oh, they're not even fighting anymore. I'm sure they would probably agree with each other now.
Well, thank you so much for giving us that overview of Jansenism and a really fascinating period of French history. You know, persecution of Protestants I was sort of aware of at this time, but it's interesting to I kind of it had escaped me the specific Jesuit v. Jansenist aspect of what was going on, and that seems like a pretty key piece of the puzzle, actually.
Well, the Protestant Reformation v. the Catholics is far more dramatic, you can say. I mean, it's far more obvious for people who like to, I'm not accusing you of this, but of dissecting history into easy to understand categories, so to speak. But what I am equally fascinated in studying is the inner turmoil of the Catholic Church, the reform movements and the competing reform movements within the Catholic Church. And the two ones that I'm emphasizing here are the crypto-Calvinist elements, which are creeping into the seminaries, as with Jansenism on the one hand. But the other, of course, is the conflict between the national churches and the church as a whole, i.e. the bishops of France versus the Pope. And so in many ways, Jansenism embodies all of these conflicts, and not just the particular historical context of the 17th and the 18th century in France, but as part of a wider phenomenon involving the entire history of the church. Indeed, bringing back to my original point, that what the Jansenists saw themselves as doing is reviving the old arguments between St. Augustine of Hippo and Pelagius. So you could say there is also an aspect of religious revivalism going in, bringing the church closer to its purported roots.